Okay. We are in the middle of our discussion of the Yirei Elokim. We saw last week towards the end of his talk, as well as the beginning, the opening statement. Just a quick review. The basic tenet of the Yirei Elokim is summed up in the expression Im Oshek Rash VeGezel. If you see poverty, oppression, evil in the world, don't dismay. That which protects is the hierarchy of one of the higher over the high. Ugvohim alehem is, as we understood it, we interpreted it to mean a hierarchical structure that is responsible for the world, not God alone, as the Nehenech claimed, nor man alone, as the Amal claimed, but the synthesis of the two, the partnership of man and God, Melech and Melech Malchei HaMelechim, King and King of Kings, essentially combined in the expression Gavoh Me'al Gavoh, he who is higher than high. And I even gave you a graphical description or a graphical depiction of that image in the form of the Beit HaMikdash, the structure of the Temple Mount, with the Temple of the Palace of Solomon and the Palace of the King of Kings, the Temple, hovering above it from the view from below. You get this visual impact of one palace hovering over another palace, and the combination, the partnership between them, ultimately being responsible for the world. That's the basic thesis of the Yirei Elokim. It's that thesis that he will work with through the entire Sefer. The partnership of responsibility that is shared between man and God. Then we went back to the beginning of the Perek, in which he begins to talk about the last verse of Perek Dalet, verse 17, Shmur aglecha kasher telecha beit Elokim. Watch yourself, guard your feet as you go into the temple. Better to heed, to listen, to obey, than to bring sacrifices of fools. A basic critique of the misinterpretation of the concept of the role of sacrifices, as the potential to understand the sacrifice as a mechanism or vehicle for the allowance of sin. A person can do what he wants and then say, I'll bring a korban to the Beit HaMikdash, I'll bring some sort of atonement sacrifice, and that'll be done with. But in fact, that's not the issue. The goal here is to obey, is to heed God's word, not to disobey and then bring atonement. We will expand on that concept momentarily, but that's the basic thesis as we saw it in the first verse. I showed you a number of examples in Tanakh where that theme is articulated by various prophets over the years. Shmuel, most profoundly in his critique to Shaul, where he says to him, Hinei shmoa mizevach tov lakshiv mechelev elim. Listening to God is more important than all the sacrifices and offerings of the fat of rams in the context of the battle, the failure of Saul at Amalek. I think we talked a little bit about the structure of the Beit HaMikdash and the significance of what's placed where. The korbanot are all on the outside, in the courtyard. They're certainly secondary in importance to the central role of the temple, which is to be the vehicle for prophecy and prayer dialogue between man and God. The temple, which acts as a conduit for God's voice of prophecy on the one hand, the instruction and our mandate to listen, to hear, karov lishmoa, mitei taksilim zava, to listen, and at the same time, to offer prayers and to supplication before God, the vehicle, the focus of our prayers. It's a conduit for that communication. Sacrifices are a component of that, but certainly not to be perverted into the primary goal, because that distorts the whole message of what the temple is all about. How that fits into the rest of this parak we did not discuss. We started looking at this verse by verse, and we said we would get to the context as a whole a little bit later. I think that's where we left off. Correct? Everybody on the same page? If you're not, it's online. You can welcome to download it, listen to it, and catch up. It's there on the shul website. Chapter 5. Al tivahel al picha. Do not be hasty with the mouth. Velibcha al yimaher lehotzi davar lifne elokim. Do not let your heart be hasty to speak words before God. What kind of words before God is Kohelet warning against? Vows, maybe he hasn't gotten to vows yet. It's a possibility.
Complaints.
If I didn't have the continuation about vows, and I just took this verse at face value, it sounds like he's saying, don't be so quick to criticize. After all, he says, Ki alukim bashamayim v'yata ala aretz, aken yudvarecha me'atim. God is in the heavens and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. In other words, who are you going to criticize? You don't see the picture. You're sitting here on earth. You're immortal. You're nothing. You're a piece of dust of the earth. God is in the heavens. You are going to speak out against God. As he says in the opening verse, Shmor raglecha kasher telecha beit elokim v'karov lishmo mitet aksilim zavach. Guard yourself when you go into the temples. Don't talk so much. Talking is only going to get you into trouble. And that's essentially what he says in the second verse as well. Al tevehel al picha. Don't let your mouth get carried away. Don't let you put your mouth before your
brain.
Right? That's exactly right. Ki alakim b'shamayim etal aretz. God is in the heavens, you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. Better to listen rather than talk. Most people find it difficult to talk and listen at the same time. It's just a fact of human nature.
Does that mean you shouldn't talk in shul?
Goes without saying. We shouldn't even need to say it. Goes without saying. What?
No, rhetorical.
That's right. Kiba chalom berov inyan. The chalom, which here I think is a dream, not in the sense of what I aspire to, what I dream about, but in the context of the vanity and the hevo picha, the dream, the nothingness, comes from too much words and the sound of the fool from too much speech. Sometimes a person talks too much and they demonstrate how foolish they really are. Kasher tidor neder lelokim al ta'acher leshalmo. If you take an oath to God, do not delay, do not tarry in fulfilling, in paying that oath. Ki ein chefetz baksilim. God has no desire for fools. Et asher tidor shalem. That which you vow, pay up. Tov asher lo tidor. Better that you not take a vow at all than that you should vow and not pay. Al titen et picha lachti et b'sarecha. Do not let your mouth cause you your flesh to sin. Meaning, if you take the vow and you don't pay up, so you now have, right, you've exacerbated the chait. Not only have you taken a vow, we'll talk about that in a moment, but you haven't paid up, so now you've really gotten yourself into trouble. You'd been better off if you would have kept your mouth shut in the first place. Ve'al tomar lifnei ha-malach kishgagai. Don't say to the angel, this is a mistake. Meaning, when the angel comes to take accountability from you for having made this oath but not paid up, what are you going to have to say? I thought I could do it. It's a shgaga, it's a mistake. You're right. When I took the vow, I thought I could handle it, but I'm sorry. You're better off not to make the mistake than to have to apologize for it. Lama yiktzof Elokim al kolecha v'chibel et maseyedech. Why should God have to get angry at your deeds? Why put yourself into that position? Kibirov chalamot v'havalim udvarim harbei. all of the dreams and the vanities and the words, all of that is best off replaced with the alternative. Better off just fear God. You have a choice between really, truly fearing God and speaking a lot and expressing all kinds of dreams and values and ideas that never come to fruition. Better fear God than to express all kinds of vanities. Let me stop here for a moment. We'll come back to the rest of this parak a little bit later, but let's stop here for a moment and deal with the question of this oath. So I think this is an important issue which we need to address and understand. We gave out a source page last week. I don't know if you have copies of it still. If you do, great. If not, there are extra copies here. So if anybody doesn't have, I'll... One that says Kohelet Perek Hei Nu'um Hayarei. Here's extras. Well, actually, I need one. This verse is the subject of a great discussion in the Talmud, Masechet Nedarim. Tov asher lo tidor mishetidor velo teshalem. Better that you not vow than that you should vow and not fulfill your vow. For the sake of argument for now, let's assume we're talking about the vow in the classic halachic sense of the term. What is the classic context of a vow, especially when you're dealing with the temple context? A korban. A person takes a vow, an oath, to bring a korban, to bring a sacrifice to the temple for whatever motivation, personal motivation they have. It's an optional, personal commitment. One wants to bring a korban. He says, Hare alai korban, I take upon myself responsibility to bring a sacrifice of some kind to the temple. He is then responsible for making sure that that animal is offered. And if he reneges on the offer for whatever reason, he has violated his oath. Says Kohelet, and certainly we're talking about a temple context in this parak, I think that's clear. Beit Elokim, house of God. Tov asher lo tidor mishetidor velo teshalem. Better off not to vow than to take a vow and not to pay. Meaning, what are my two alternatives? What are the two alternatives painted here in this picture? Alternative number one, to which I have two options. One is better than the other. Alternative number one, right? Take a vow, right? Take a vow, whatever it is, you want to take a vow, you want to bring a vow, you want to bring a sacrifice, you take a vow and you say, okay, I'm going to bring whatever it is, an Ola offering the next Monday. And do you bring the offering?
No.
Right? Mishetidor velo teshalem is option two. Option two is you make the vow, and you either forget, or you run out of money, or you go bankrupt, or you decide not to do it, or you decide to give the money to somebody else. Whatever the context is, you take the vow and you renege. That's option two. What's option one? Right? Tov asher lo tidor. It's better not to make the offer at all. Not to take the oath, not to bring the sacrifice. Not clear whether not to take the oath means not to bring the sacrifice at all, or not to say that you're going to bring the sacrifice. We'll talk about that in a moment. But between the two alternatives, says Kohelet, I'd rather have a situation where people don't take the vow in the first place than take the vow and not fulfill it. There's a third option that's not in this verse. What's the third option? Tidor v'tishalem. That third option is not in the verse. The verse talks about two possibilities. Not taking the oath at all, or taking the oath and bringing the sacrifice. Taking the oath and not fulfilling the oath. Between those two options, says Kohelet, you're better off not taking the oath altogether. The question that I ask you, and the question that is asked in the Gemara in Masechet Nedarim is, what is the status of the third alternative? Which is to take the oath and to fulfill it. Is the concern here, in this verse, as it seems to be articulated, is the concern a practical one, meaning that to take the oath puts yourself in a position of risk? Let's assume for the moment whatever the risks are, whatever the chances are. Anything can happen. Right? The animal could die, you could go bankrupt, the stock markets could crash. Oh, anything can happen. Is the concern here one of risk management? Meaning, the moment you take the oath, you put yourself into the possibility that you will be unable to fulfill it, although there is a possibility that you could, this risk is too great, and therefore your better alternative is that which is always risk-free. Is that his message? Or is his message that even if you knew you could fulfill the oath, you are better off not taking the oath at all? That's the question. Is it a risk management issue only? Now, to this question, I want to show you first the passage in the Gemara in Masechet Nedarim, and then I'll come back to the verse. This is the text itself. I will come back to the text in a moment. Take a look at source number one. Masechet Nedarim, Daf Tet Amud Aleph, Titania. Learned in a brighter, Tov asher lo tidor mishetidor velo tashalem, quotes our verse from Kohelet. Tov mizeh umizeh she'eno noder kol ika. Better than one or the other, meaning, if my alternative is to take an oath and pay, or to take an oath and not pay, the best alternative is always not to take the oath at all. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Tov mizeh umizeh noderu mishalem. The better alternative than the two presented in the verse, which is either not to take the oath, or to take the oath and not pay, the best alternative is always take the oath and fulfill it. Make the pledge and make good on the pledge. That's always the best alternative. That's the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir says, no, you're better off not making the oath at all. Furthermore, the Gemara goes on to say in source number two, Tanya Rabbi Natan Omer, in the position of Rabbi Meir, who says that you're better off not making the oath at all, Tanya Hanoder Ki'ilu Banabama, the Hamakaimo Ki'ilu Makrivalav Korban. If you take an oath, it's as if you've built an altar outside of the temple, which is not allowed. Can't build an altar outside of the temple. It's called a Bama. High place. If you take the oath, you make an oath, it's as if you built yourself your own private little altar. And if you fulfill the oath by bringing the korban in the betim in the temple that you promised you would bring, it's as if you sacrifice an offering on your own private little altar in your backyard. Which is pretty harsh. That's a pretty harsh statement. That's the position of a man. So in fact, this question, which I asked somewhat rhetorically, turns out to be a dispute between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that the best alternative is always, Rabbi Yehuda's opinion is, the best alternative is
take it and do it.
Whereas Reb Meir is of the opinion that of my three options, and you understand that there are three options: no vow, vow unfulfilled, vow fulfilled. Reb Yehuda says the best option is always the vow fulfilled. It's just a question of risk. Reb Meir says no. The best option is always no vow altogether. Which is?
No vow and then still do it?
We haven't discussed the question of what no vow at all means. Does no vow mean you don't say that you're going to bring the korban, you just bring it because you decide you want to do it? Or does no vow mean no vow and no korban? I haven't discussed that issue yet. For now, we're just dealing with the question of the vow. Between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, which of these two positions sounds most in accordance with the simple text, the pshat of the verse? Rav Meir. Why do you say Rav Meir? The pshat of the text that says, better not to take a vow than to take a vow and not fulfill it. Does that verse imply that if you could take the oath and fulfill it, if you knew that there was no risk involved, if you could remove the risk from the equation and knew that if you took an oath, you could fulfill that oath, Rav Meir says you're better off still not taking the oath. And Rav Yehuda says, no, if you know you can fulfill it, then absolutely you should take it. Which is reflected in the text itself. The text reads, it is better not to take a vow than to take a vow and let it go unfulfilled. I think Rav Yehuda is the more is the implication of the verse. The implication sounds to me like it's a question of risk management. Since my alternative is taking the vow and not having it fulfilled, or not taking the vow at all, but given the choice between those two options, you're better off not vowing than leaving the vow unfulfilled. But his concern seems to be the unfulfilled oath. Whereas, if I could remove the risk from the equation, and I knew that I could fulfill the oath, it seems that Rabbi Yehuda's position should be the most logical. Correct? What is wrong with taking an oath if you know you're going to fulfill that oath? You're going to live up to your word.
You don't really know you're going to be able to live up to it.
I said, if you could take the risk out of the equation. In other words, what it seems to be saying is that there's a risk management issue here. You never know that you're going to be able to fulfill it. But if you could, as if you could take the risk out of the equation, then there seems to be an advantage to taking an oath today that I'm going to bring a sacrifice next week and bringing the sacrifice.
And there must be some value or merit in making a vow.
And according to Rabbi Yehuda, there is a great merit
right.
if you know you're going to be able to fulfill it.
If you make so it must be better right? to make a vow than not to make a vow.
According to Rabbi Yehuda,
something
is gained by making a vow, which is why it's so prevalent and why people did it. But it's a risk. And Kohelet says, hey, that's a very risky business. So at any time you have risk, right? When you invest money in the stock market, that's a risk, right? Some people like to live with that risk, and some people prefer to put the money into... Right, into savings or into bonds, which have a fixed return, because they don't like risk. They can't live with risk. Kohelet doesn't like risk. And he says, I'd rather take the safe and secure, even though I achieve less, I'd rather take the safe route than the risky route that could potentially achieve more. That seems to be the pshat of the pasuk. The problem here is that the halacha is not in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda. The halacha is in accordance with Rabbi Meir. Strongly so. Take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 is the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch rules as follows. Al tehi ragil bin adarim. A person should not make it a habit of, should not be in the habit of taking oaths. Kol hanoder
Af al pisha mekaimo. If you take an oath, even if you fulfill the oath, nikra rasha v'nikra chote, called a sinner and a wicked person. Even if you fulfill the oath, skip the next paragraph. Hanoder, he quotes the second passage that we read earlier. Hanoder ki ilu bene bama b'shat isura bamot. If you take an oath, it's as if you built yourself an altar at a time when you're not allowed to build an altar, and it says, and if you fulfill the oath, it's as if you've offered a sacrifice on this forbidden altar. Tov sheyishalat nidro. If you happen by accident to take an oath, so you're better off going to a Beit Din and having your oath annulled. Yeah, look at Tziv Dalet. Look at Tziv Dalet. Up until now, he's been quoting from the Gemara in the context of the discussion, which is about a korban. Our context of oath is usually about pledges for tzedakah, correct? So look at Tziv Dalet. Tzarich li zaher shelo yidor shum davar. A person has to be very careful not to make an oath for anything. Afilu tzedakah ein tov lidor. It's even better not to take an oath for charity. Ella, im yeshno biado yiten miyad. If you have the money, you give it to charity. You play games with pledges. You have the money, you give it. However, v'im lav lo yido ad shiyelo. If you don't have it, so don't promise that which you don't have. V'im poskim tzedaka v'tzarich lifsokim mehem. If the custom has become that people are making pledges and you feel you have to make a pledge with everybody else, yomar b'li neder, you should do so by saying explicitly that this is without the status of a vow. Can't make a vow. Powerful words. That's what the propensity for everybody to constantly say b'li neder is all about, right? We say b'li neder every half a sentence. When it comes to our real pledges, you know, then we make a pledge and we don't live up to it. We forget to say b'li neder. This is that's a whole different discussion.
Apparently, vows were very common.
They were very common.
The question is, and now I come back to the position of Rabbi Meir, in which we paskin, that's the halacha. Where does this come from? If the pshat of the pasuk is in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda's position, where does Rabbi Meir's position emanate from?
It's not risk management.
It's not risk management. Rabbi Meir, it's got nothing to do with risk management. It's a theological position. The difference between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir is fundamental. According to Rabbi Yehuda, vows are fundamentally a good thing. The only problem is they come with risk. So let's manage the risk. According to Rabbi Meir, they are fundamentally a bad thing, an evil thing.
So it's
better not to make the vow ever, even if you knew you could fulfill it. The question, I understand where Rabbi Yehuda comes from. Rabbi Yehuda's position emanates from the text itself. Where does Rabbi Meir's position come from? It's a beautiful example of a machloket in the Gemara that seems to be divorced of the pshat of the pasuk, but in fact, when you start to look at it, you find that it's very much a machloket in how to read the text. The only difference is that Rabbi Yehuda is focused on the text, whereas Rabbi Meir is focused on text. Rabbi Yehuda is focused on text, and Rabbi Meir is focused on the context. Meaning Rabbi Yehuda is focused on this verse. Rabbi Meir is reading the entire passage. It is true that you could interpret this verse to mean, if you looked at it by itself, that your best option is not to vow at all. Sorry, that your best option is to vow and fulfill the vow. But now look at the entire context of the passage, from the beginning to the end. And what is Kohelet saying in this passage? If you look at it as a focus on vows, on speaking, when you speak, what are you speaking? You're speaking a vow to bring an offering to the temple.
Don't be hasty.
Don't be hasty. Al tevehel alpicha. Watch yourself. Keep your mouth shut. Why? Ki alokim b'shamayim v'yata al haaretz. Because God is in the heavens and you are on earth. Al ken yudvarecha me'atim. Therefore let your words be few. He's not saying don't say anything because you'll trip yourself, you won't fulfill your oath. He's saying God is in the heavens and you are on earth. Therefore, yudvarecha me'atim. Keep your mouth shut. Don't talk so much.
This is to tie in with humility, then, isn't it? Or is it?
Humility on a very broad scale. I'll come back to the concept in a second. Okay. Let's take a look at a couple of additional verses where he talks about karov lishmoa, mite taksilim zavach. Better off listening than bringing the sacrifices of fools. Al tevehel apichol otzi davar lifnei ha'elokim. Don't speak words before God. Kol aksilim berov tvarim. The voice of the fool is in the speech. Kasher tidor. If you're going to take an oath, do not delay. At asher tidor teshalem. If you're going to take an oath, so fulfill it. But you're better off not taking an oath. Al titen et picha lachti et b'sarecha. Don't let your mouth make yourself sin. In other words, if I look at the whole context, it's a broad sweep at the whole notion of an articulated position of an oath before God. Why? What is the philosophical or theological background to the notion that you're better off not taking an oath altogether, even if you knew you could fulfill it? Look at it from the perspective of, we're in the middle of an election year. Look at it from the perspective of an election campaign, election promise. An election promise, I promise to do X, Y, and Z. It's quite possible that a person will make that promise and fulfill the promise. It's possible. Miracles have been known to happen. Right? May not be practical, but it's certainly possible. Says Kohelet, don't open your mouth. Even if you could fulfill it, why not? What's the theological issue here?
It's about the nature of speech. Say things that he puts it as comes from multiple dreams and vanities and many words. And the idea is that's bad.
Because God is in the heavens and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. What does that mean?
Because you don't know what's going to happen.
Because there's a built-in presumption or there's a built-in arrogance in the very act of taking an oath. The arrogance is the assumption that life is in your hands to control. I take an oath because I think that I'm in control. And therefore I can guarantee, I can make a promise to you. Because I have the ability to fulfill that promise. I know it's in my bank account, and I know that I can make a commitment to the Beit HaMikdash of 5 korbanot, because I know I can get the money. And if I don't have it, I know I can get it by tomorrow. Because I know what my financial position is, and I'm sure I can do it. The reality is, I know nothing, and I'm sure of nothing. And that's fundamentally the other message of the Yirei Elokim. We'll see it at the end of Kohelet. How much we don't know. Ki incha yodeh will be a theme that the Yirei Elokim will come back to. We know nothing in life. We think we know everything, but we know nothing. Ultimately, the only one who knows is ki alokim b'shamayim v'atal aretz, because God is in the heavens and we are on earth. That's the humility you spoke of before. The moment I articulate a vow, the moment I make the assumption that I am in control, that's the assumption of any vow. Because if I didn't think that I could fulfill it, I wouldn't make the vow in the first place. That Arrogance, says Rav Meir, is the equivalent of building my own altar. Why? Because I'm building my own temple. I'm making my own definitions. I'm in complete control. The concept of a korban is to recognize I come into God's temple and into God's palace, and God is the king and I am the servant. The concept of the korban is to recognize that there are circumstances in life where I am not in control. Things happen that I can't control, and when they happen, I have to bring a sin of atonement. I have to bring a korban for it. To build my own altar is to say, I'm in control of the world. That's fundamentally a problem. So says Rav Meir, told me, Shnema Shilotidov, you better not take me out. Keep your mouth quiet. Keep your mouth shut. Just do. You have to bring the korban, bring the korban. But the moment you articulate that tomorrow at 12 o'clock noon, I'm going to bring a korban to the Beit HaMikdash, you assume that you know what's going to happen at 12 o'clock noon tomorrow afternoon. We know nothing. That is the ultimate expression of humility. Certainly vis-a-vis God. So I think Rav Meir is very much based on the broader context of this perek, which speaks of the relationship we have to God and the caution we have to have when we speak about God. It's one piece of this that's missing, which is, you look like you're about to ask a question.
I don't know if this is, it just seems to me that we're deriving halacha from Koheles when you have this parallel thing in Kiseitse, and reading it that, I get the context differently.
What do you get in context of Kiseitse?
There it's almost like you're going to do it, and v'chisech dal v'ndor lo yeh b'chafet. I mean, it's like you should be doing it, but if you don't do it, don't worry, it's not a sin not to do it. Really, that doesn't sound like you shouldn't be doing it b'chafila. And I don't know how they're deriving stuff from Koheles over what seems to be a more powerful statement than what he says.
That's a fair question. I would say it's a halacha question for the discussion of the Gemara Nidar. A valid challenge to raise in the context of the study of the passage in the Gemara. In the context of Kohelet, yeah, I'm actually, it's a separate issue.
But this is, okay. These are the Chacham in the Gemara.
100%. Right. I'll leave it as a kasha for now. But I have a different question. How did we end up talking about Korbanot? Where does the context of a korban fit into the broader discussion of Kohelet, the Amal, and the Ne'eneh, and the themes that we're dealing with and the challenges of life? Suddenly he starts talking about sacrifices. It's a fair discussion to have in the context of the Beit HaMikdash. When you come to the Beit HaMikdash, you don't want to start promising that you're going to bring korbanot. Why? Because you don't know that you can. How does that answer any issue that we've raised in the book?
Well, it does.
Here we said it.
Yes.
Right? Here he's talking about that.
Right.
But how does that address the issues that the Amal and the Ne'eneh raised in terms of the broad context of righteousness and good people and bad people and the righteous who suffer and the oppression in the world? Talk about sacrifices. You've jumped from it's the ultimate non sequitur. I'll go one step further. Let's narrow the question. Verse 1, this first chapter, the opening verse of this chapter, Al tevehel al picha, do not be hasty with your mouth. V'libcha al yemehel otzi davar lifnei ha'elokim, ki elokim b'shamayim v'yata la'aretz. Do not be hasty before God. God is in the heavens and you are on earth. When we read that verse the first time, we understood it to mean, do not raise complaints or critique against God. Do not criticize God. And that's a valid position to take in the context of Kohelet. Everybody else has been critical. The Ne'eneh has been critical. The Yirei Elokim has been critical. The Amal has been critical. So comes along the Yirei Elokim and he says to everybody else in the discussion, folks, calm down a little bit. Stop being so critical. And then he starts talking about sacrifices. Then he starts talking about oaths. What's essentially the relationship between the complaint, the critique, and the oath? That's my question. What's the relationship between the critique of God and the oath? They both assume we know more than God. If we're going to criticize God, it means we assume we can know we can know more than God. And the oath? Broaden the context of an oath.
Responsibility.
What's the relationship between a critique and a promise? Spell it out. We're in an election year.
Okay, I don't like it, and therefore I can do it better.
Correct. One is a prerequisite before the other. One is a consequence of the other. So what motivates a person to make an oath or a promise? The sense of something's not right, the critique. And therefore the assumption that I can do it better. It's built into the very concept of an oath, says the Yirei Elokim, built into the very notion of an oath is an underlining assumption, whether a person makes that assumption consciously or not. But the assumption is that there's some critique about the way the world is operating, and I am articulating a position that says, I don't like this. It's not right. It needs to be better. It needs to be handled better. It needs to be effective different. It needs to be affected differently. The outcome needs to be different. The assumption that I'm in control. The very act of a korban is easily misunderstood as a message of control. And you asked the question before, are we talking about not making an oath or not bringing the korban? In the context of Kohelet, I think he's talking about not bringing the korban altogether. Karov lishmoa mite taksilim zavach. Stop bringing sacrifices, because the sacrifices were understood as a mechanism of control. I bring a sacrifice for what purpose? If I bring a sacrifice, I control the world. I control the world spiritually. I control God. I can manipulate God. I know when God's hungry. I know when God wants this kind of a korban, and I know when God wants that kind of a korban. Then if God is hungry, I can bring this kind of a sacrifice. And if he's got this, he'll bring that kind of a sacrifice. And before you know it, I am in complete control of everything that happens in the world because I operate the temple court. And to all of that, Kohelet takes a step back and he says, enough. The purpose is not to bring sacrifices. The purpose is to listen to God, not to criticize God. The purpose is not to think we are in control of this world, but to recognize that ultimately God is in control of this world. That was precisely the answer God gave to Job. It's a fascinating story, the end of Job. Job spends 39 chapters complaining bitterly about God and about the injustice of his life. And God comes to Job at the end of the book, in chapter 40, and he says to him, if you can control the Leviathan, or the behemoth, I'll give in to you. Leviathan is this great fish. A behemoth is this giant sea monster. So if you can tame the sea monster, I'll give you anything you want. How does that answer his question? How is that an answer to Job's challenge? The Leviathan, the behemoth, these giant sea monsters are a symbol in the context of Tanakh. They are a symbol for a world that is inherently unfair and unjust to the point of evil. What's the Leviathan? It's this giant monster of the sea that opens up, giant fish, opens up his mouth, and what happens? Swallows everything it sees. And all these little fishalach, who are really innocent, poor fishalach, they've got nothing against anybody, get devoured in one fell swoop by this giant Leviathan, or behemoth. Where's the justice? Where's the fairness? says God to Kohelet, if you can tame the Leviathan, if you think you can run the world better than I do, isn't that? The job is yours. And that's exactly what he says to him. The job is yours. Go for it. In a world that has to be run by the laws of nature, you do it. You want my job so much? Stop criticizing. The job is open. Can you do a better job? That's the core of God's answer to Job. It's a fascinating answer. It's a rhetorical answer. And he says to him, where were you when I made the heavens? And where were you when I made the mountains? And where were you when I made the valleys? And if you can flatten the hills, and if you can straighten out the rivers, then you can have the job. And if you can tame the Leviathan, you can have the job. It's a rhetorical answer. But it's the same answer that's embedded into this chapter in Kohelet. We are not in control of this world. And the presumption, the arrogance to think that we have the ability to quote-unquote criticize God means that we assume that we can do a better job than God can. So God turns to Eov, metaphorically, and he says, here's the scepter, you do it. The job is yours. Stop promising to make the world a better place. You don't have the ability, you don't have the control. When Shlomo Melech said that the ultimate solution to the problems of the world lies in the powers of the king, whether it be Shlomo Melech, whether it be Yerevan ben Nevat, whatever, whoever it was, when the Amal said the ultimate solution to the problems in the world lie with the power of the king, he is in control. He has the power, he has the authority, he has the wealth. He's going to solve the problems of the world. What does the real Elohim say to him? Don't talk so much. That's what he says. He says, stop talking. Stop talking and do. Stop talking and do. You want to change the world? Go do something good for the world. But stop talking. All I hear is a lot of promises. I hear oaths. I hear vows. I hear critique. I hear truth. What are you doing? And then you throw your hands up in the air and you say, oh, I failed. Can't be done. Because you failed, it can't be done. The arrogance is astounding. Shlomo HaMelech, because he failed, it can't be done. That was exactly what happened at the end of Perek Dalet. He presented, gave us this whole picture, Chut HaMishalash, Lo B'Marayin HaTek, the three-ply string, a rope, it's all in the hands of Shlomo. Couldn't do it. So he handed the reins over to this young whippersnapper called Yerevan ben Nevat. Everything's in his hands. He couldn't do it. So what does Shlomo say? Can't be done. The Elohim says to him, what kind of an arrogant statement is that? Who are you? He says to himself. Right? He's talking to himself, you understand. And who are you, Shlomo? And because you couldn't do it, it can't be done. Last I checked, this world was a partnership between man and God. You do your share, God will do his. But you absolve man of all responsibility because you couldn't do it? Which is essentially the same argument to the Nehenneh. What was the Nehenneh's argument? It's God's responsibility. What a cop-out. What a cop-out. It's God's responsibility. What a beautiful world we live in. God made a perfect world. You know what? Get a life. God didn't make a perfect world. You know it and I know it. The world's not perfect. Al tevehel picha. Don't talk so much. Narishkeit. Berov dvarim. What's the expression? V'kol ksil berov dvarim. The more you talk, the more foolishness comes out of your mouth, says Kohelet. That the world is a perfect place? And that ultimately God is completely in control, and God is going to fix the world, and God is going to solve the problems of the world. In the meantime, people are killing each other on the streets. Your responsibility is to come to the Beit HaMikdash, sit down and take a lesson. Listen carefully. Tov lishmoa. But that's your responsibility. That's what you have to do. Throw everything back onto the shoulders of God and you walk around scot-free. You get to do anything you like because ultimately God is in control. I can put a bullet in somebody's head. God made me do it. So he's talking about oaths, but he's talking about words. A philosophy of an attitude vis-a-vis who's controlling the world and who's responsible for this world. That was the theme of the Nehneh. That was the theme of the Amal. It's into that arena that the Yirei Elokim steps and he says, everybody's talking about as if they're in control or they're not in control. And everybody's making all kinds of wonderful words and wonderful philosophies and wonderful promises, unfulfilled and unchallenged. But there's an arrogance underlining the very assumption of the Nehneh and the Amal. And it's that arrogance that the Yirei Elokim challenges. Tov lishmoa ite taksilim zavach. I don't need sacrifices from the Yirei Elokim, and I don't need temples, and I don't need the promises to change and to fix the world and all the campaign promises of any election in Jewish history. I need foot soldiers who are going to show up, sit down, listen, understand the responsibility in the world, and then go do. Is this part clear? Okay. Which brings us to the last part of this parak. After he articulates this picture of this partnership between man and God in verse 7, he seems to digress into something that looks much like the philosophy of, I don't know, the kibbutz movement. Right, in early Zionism. V'yitron eretz bakol hi melech usadeh ne'evad. The advantage of the earth over all is a king who works the field. Ohev kesef lo yizbak kesef. If you desire money, you'll never be satiated by money. Umi ohev behamon lo tvua. And if a person wants to amass much, he will have nothing. Gam zahav, certainly vain and nothing. The more one has, rabu achla, the more people, mouths there are to feed. And therefore, the more it gets consumed. What does the owner have to have of it except his own portion? Whereas, mitukashna ta'oved, the worker, his sleep is sweet. Whether he eats a lot or eats a little, he sleeps well. But it's the very wealth of the wealthy, the satisfying wealth of the wealthy, that doesn't let him sleep at night. Which is a direct reference to a verse earlier. Where was it? Anybody know? Chapter 2, verse 23. Kol yamav machovim v'kas inyano gam balayla lo shechav libo gam ze havalu. The last word of the first opening chapter of the Amal. All his days are filled with pain and anger, and at night he cannot sleep. This is vanity. Says Shlomo HaMelech, you know who can't sleep? The wealthy. The owner. The balabait, the guy who's looking after his bank account. But you know who sleeps really well? The worker. The oved. Why? Why? So he's tired from all his hard work, so he gets to sleep well. Right? But that's not what he says. He says, why does he get to sleep well? Satisfying to work. Right? Satisfied with his lot. Because he doesn't run the treadmill of never having achieved his goal. If my goal is to amass a small fortune, I will never be satisfied because every time I have a semi-small fortune, the definition of small gets bigger. which is exactly how Kohelet started. That the endless cycle, and the cycle of the water that went into the river, right? And that never was said, and that never got kol amal adam lefiu v'gam nefesh lokti maleh. The more all of the toil of man goes into his mouth, and he's never satisfied. The more we have, the more we want. It's a fascinating aspect of human nature, but it's absolutely true, and it applies to all physical desires. The more food we eat, the hungrier we get. It applies to all physical desires. The more we have, the more we want. We can never be satiated. Ezehu ashir hasameach b'chalko, when Chazal said that the wealthy is the one who is satisfied with their lot, they were essentially articulating this position in Kohelet. Because to really be satisfied, I have, yeshli dai, as Yaakov says to Esau. I have enough. That's a bracha. It doesn't have to have an amount attached to it. What's the definition of enough? 100,000 or a million? What's the definition of enough? Is enough to put food on my table for the evening meal? Or is enough to pay all my 14... servants who maintain my mansion? What's enough? Now, what Kohelet does is he introduces the concept of an oved.
Melech, Sadeh, Ne'evad, or Mituka Shnat Ha'oved,
meaning sleep, not years of.
Mituka Shnat Ha'oved.
What is the Oved? Now we have another word in Kohelet very similar to the Oved, namely Amal. We've been dealing with the word amal since the beginning of the Sefer. Right? Suddenly, Kohelet has introduced a word that is very similar to amal. Amal means toil, labor. Oved means work. They both have a similar connotation. But in the context of Kohelet, they mean vastly different things. Vastly different things. Up until now, we've only had the word amal, and past these three psukim, we will only ever see the word amal. The word oved appears in one place in Kohelet and one place only, and that's here. What is the difference fundamentally between amal and oved, or between amelut and avodah? First of all, attitudinally. What is the attitude in Kohelet to the concept of amal? A positive one or a negative one?
Negative.
Very negative one. He's challenged by this concept of amal. Misaneti ani et kol amali. I hated all my toil. Mao vel adam b'chol amalo. What achievement do I have with all of my toil and my effort? Velama ani amal. Why am I toiling and doing all of this? For nothing, for naught. On the other hand, in these three psukim, what's his attitude to the Oved? Positive one or negative one?
Very positive.
Mitukashnat Oved. He's the only one who can sleep at night. So what fundamentally is the difference between the Amal and the Oved? Why is the Amal so distraught and the Oved so satisfied?
Well, it deals with land. So the Oved basically goes to nature where he has no control and knows he has no control. He plants seed, but he doesn't know there'll be rain. You know, all the risks are there. And yet he does it with humility because he knows that it's not in his control. So therefore, he is being obedient to his maker.
That's the explanation of the Oved in the broad context of Sefer Kohelet. Right? In other words, how this fits into the Yirei Elokim overall. I think you're correct. Right? You're borrowing from some of what we've seen at the end of the Sefer as well. But specifically in the context of these verses, there's a different element that I wanted to pick up on that I think is the specific context of these three verses. The Amal essentially...
Manages.
I'm not even sure that's the context of these verses. I think the context here is that the Amal fundamentally is toil for the purpose of achieving a goal. Whatever that goal is. That goal could be very important. That goal could be resolving the injustice of the world. Dim'ata ashukim ve'en lehem menachem. The Amal started with the tear of the oppressed. Somebody has to take the responsibility for all of these oppressed people in the world. That's the job of the Amal. To work, to toil, to build, to create, to change, to transform.
That's not negative at all.
It's not negative. What's negative is that it's unachievable. In other words, the negativity is not built into the fact that I'm a Amal for a purpose. The negativity is his frustration that because he's driven for an achievement or a goal, that goal constantly eludes him. V'lama ani mechaseret nafshi, for what am I going to... L'mi ani amel umechaseret nafshi mitova, for whom am I toiling and doing all of this? At the end of the day, it goes nowhere. I don't have an heir to give it to, I don't have somebody to share it with, I don't have the achievement of the goal, I haven't solved the problem of injustice in the world. Whatever my goal is set, umayitron shi'amal l'ruach, what purpose is there that I should toil to the wind? Why is he toiling to the wind? Because he's achieving nothing? He's not achieving nothing. He achieves great things. He builds great buildings. Look at everything that he achieved in chapter 2. Nobody built more than Shlomo HaMelech. All of the vineyards and the palaces and the courtyards and the orchards and the plants and the trees and the judgments and the mishpat and everything that Shlomo HaMelech achieved in his life. Did he achieve nothing? Of course he achieved. He built the Beit HaMikdash. He built a great empire. He built a Malchus. Did he not achieve a great deal? But the fundamental difference is that the Amal, by definition, of toil for the goal, if I don't reach the goal, then all my toil is
for naught.
Because the definition of amal is toil for the sake of achieving my goal. And if that's the meaning of it, and if I don't get to the very end, I'm frustrated. That's what Kohelet means here when he says, Ohev kesef, lo yizba kesef. Umi ohev behamon lo tvua. If my goal is money, I'll never be satiated. If my goal is abundance, I'll never have the wheat. Meaning, whatever the Amal is going to try to achieve, whether it be money, whether it be power, whether it be prestige, whether it be altruistic goals, whatever those goals are, if the end all and be all of the criteria of success is I've reached the end of my goal and I have achieved it, I will forever remain frustrated. Whereas the definition of Oved, Metuka Shnata Oved, what's the difference between the worker and the owner? The owner, he's not out in the field. He's sitting there counting
the money.
So to him, everything's built around the end result. Whereas the Oved, the worker in the field, im ma'at ve'im harbe, if he brings home a lot that day, great. And if he brings home a little that day, he's paid by the hour. He's out in the field by the hour. If there was a drought that year, and there's very little to harvest off the crop, he gets the same maskara. So when he goes home at night, he's not worried about the fact that there was a drought and that there was very little to invest in the, or to deposit in the bank. His goal is to go out to the next day and do the work. Work for the sake of
work.
Work for the sake of work. Oved. Mitukash not oved. You can sleep well at night. Imat mimarbe. That's the fundamental difference between the Oved and the Amal. The Amal is goal-oriented toil. If I don't achieve the goal, I'm toiling for naught. Oved is the process of service, the process of work. That's fascinating. The word Oved is also the term used for Avodat Hashem. Avodat Shebelev, Tfila. Because, right? The whole spiritual enterprise is defined as avodah, avodat korbanot, whether it be the temple service, whether avodat avalev, prayer service, or avodat Hashem. So, however you define, the entire spiritual enterprise is defined by the term oved, not by the term amal. On the contrary, outside of the context of Kohelet, in Tanakh, the word amal is synonymous with evil. In Eov, in Mishle, in Tehillim, if you find the word amal, it means sin, iniquity, or evil. Look it up in a concordancia. There's about 40 different references. And every single one of them has an extremely negative connotation. It's the exact opposite of Oved in the context of Avodat Hashem. Why?
But you have a Shem in the sequence. Mm-hmm.
In these verses, you don't. In these verses, he looks. It's a metaphor, right? You have Avodat Hashem. In these particular verses, it's a metaphor. He hasn't introduced God into those verses. He's just dealt with the metaphor of the Oved versus the Amal, because the Oved is not goal oriented. The Oved is working for the sake of working. If I achieve this much, whether I achieve much or I achieve little, I achieve this much. I achieve this much. I achieve this much. Whatever I achieve is pure profit. To put it succinctly, and to put it in the most direct terms that I know of, the position of the Yirei Elokim can be summarized with one Mishnah. Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, you all know it.
Too little and say much.
That's one. That's not the Mishnah. That's a different phrase, but it essentially means the same thing, right? Do much and say little. Okay, that's one half of it. The Mishnah that I was right. The Mishnah that I was thinking of was Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor velo ata ben chorin li batel mimenu. Yours is mission is not to finish the job, but that doesn't exempt you from the effort. At the core, that's the position of the Yirei Elokim. And I go back to the hierarchy. That's gavah mi'al gavah. The reason for that is that there's a partnership between man and God. Ours is a responsibility to do whatever is within our power to achieve the goals that the Torah sets for us, including all of the challenges of society and the injustice of society and the unfairness, whether it be unfairness of nature or the challenges of illness or the challenges of evil in the world. Whatever the challenges are in this world, they are our responsibility to overcome. Now, our responsibility, let me rephrase that, our responsibility to try to overcome. To whatever extent we are successful, we have done our share. And then we sit back and said, okay, God, now you're in control ultimately, so you take the next step. That's the partnership. That's gavoa mi'al gavoa. That's why the Oved Hashem is an Oved Adama. He's not the Amal. He's not toiling because he's not trying to finish the job. He's trying to do his share. Mitukash nata oved. And for whatever he achieves, that's his job. And the rest belongs to God. Ultimately, that's the position of the Yirei Elokim. That's where it starts here, and that will be his position till the end of the Sefer. It's a partnership. Not like the Nehenah,
who says ultimately the world is God's responsibility and we are absolved of all effort to try. And unlike the Amal, who says the world is man's responsibility and total control and authority belongs to man, and God has no partner in it, no role in it. The Arei Elokim's position is that the world is a partnership between man and God. The avodah, the concept of work, an effort, which is to try to do the best we can and to leave the rest up to God, even unfinished. I put a little chart together, which is essentially a summation of the three positions we've had up until now. I will leave that with you. It essentially has summation of everything that we've just articulated in these two sentences. Just review it with you quickly. Essentially, four themes that we have seen addressed in each of these three positions. Everybody have? These are the actual. The four themes are, number one, responsibility for justice. Who is responsible for justice in this world? The Nehneh says it is the responsibility of God. Mm-hmm. God will judge. The Amal says it is the responsibility of man, the dimata ashukim, the tear of the oppressed. The Arei Elokim speaks of the partnership gavoa me'al gavoa. As to the role of the king in all of this, meaning the role of the human being, the role of the king is a metaphor for society as a whole, the Nehneh has no role for man. The Amal has complete responsibility for man. And the Arei Elokim, again, that partnership gavoa me'al gavoa. Relationship to God. The ability to critique God. The Nehneh is certainly not going to critique God because ultimately God is in complete control. It's a kol asaya fe bi'ito. God runs the world. The Amal, not only does he have the authority to critique God, he does so quite explicitly. One of the most, we didn't discuss this much, but remember that statement when the Amal said, Tov mishnehem at asher aden lo haya? Better than the one who has lived and the one who has died is the one who was never born. If there's ever a critique of God, that's it. Better not to be born means God made a mistake. And he'll say it later in the book. Kishgaga yatse mi pi hashalit. Like a mistake that the thought that the king made. The Arei Elokim certainly is not prepared to criticize God in the context of oaths and sacrifices and promises. Man's responsibility is to listen, to hear, to obey, to be part of that partnership. And finally, the concept of human effort. Again, to the Nehneh, human effort is futile. Hakol asaya fe bito, God is in control. To the Amal, the goal is to strive for perfection and total control. Me'uvat lo yichal litkon, that which is corrupt can't be fixed. The goal here is perfection. To the Arei Elokim, the goal is avodah, a partnership, not to finish the work, but not to be exempt from it. That's essentially a summary of the three positions we have seen to date. The next perek, actually it's two prakim. It's Vav and Zayin. The next perek is the end of Hay and Vav. It's a perek and a half. It's the final summation arguments of the Amal before the Amal will rest his case and write himself out of the book. And then we will introduce the Chacham in the second half of the Sefer. So from there we move forward. Okay, so we'll stop here.